Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Afshin Mehin, designer and founder of Woke Studio, and we're going to talk about thought-based interfaces. This episode is brought to you by UserList, a lifecycle messaging tool for SaaS companies. It's perfect for sending smart onboarding campaigns or any other behavior-based communication. We have everything you need to get started quickly and painlessly. Developer-friendly API, campaign templates, and hands-on support from the founders. Try UserList free at userlist.com. Hi, Afshin.
Hey, how are you doing, Jane?
Doing great. Thanks so much for joining us today for this fantastic direct and non-direct meaning of this word conversation.
Yeah, you bet. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so today we're going to tap into future technologies, talk about science and other exciting things.
I'm excited to get started. Let's do it.
Before we get started, could you please give us an overview of what you do and what's your background story? Because your studio is pretty famous. We have everyone who's listening, I highly recommend visiting the website. There are some amazing visuals and some amazing products out there.
Thanks, Jane. That's super kind. Yeah, I'm happy to give you a bit of background on myself and the studio. So I am kind of a hybrid designer, I guess. I started out studying engineering, and then I moved into industrial design. And then while I was doing that, I was working in research labs, working on future technologies. And then after graduating from school, I moved to Silicon Valley, like a lot of designers do, and I work for design studios. I worked for one called IDEO, which does innovation and design thinking. And I was working there as kind of a hybrid between an interaction designer, which is a UI UX, but kind of in the broader term, and an industrial designer, which does the physical products. And that was a real thrill for me. And it's kind of been a cornerstone for how I've kind of developed and grown the studio. I personally have a strong belief that being able to deliver on great user experiences across hardware and software makes for great brands. And so being able to be a design studio that is strong in that area or those areas is something I believe is beneficial for companies and helps them develop great user experiences and product experiences. So yeah, set up a studio. I studied in London and then I moved back to London back in the early 2010s, spent a little bit of time there working for some design studios. Funny fact, I work on the 2012 Olympic torch designing the hole pattern in there. So next time you take a look at that, those are my holes. And when we came back to London, we set up studio in Vancouver. So Vancouver is where the studio originated, my hometown. And then in 2016, moved back down to San Francisco, the Bay Area, and had both studios working. And it's been an interesting array of projects. We've done a lot of work around health and wellness. And because the Pacific Northwest and West Coast is generally just a very outdoor-focused part of the world where people like to go hiking or biking, running, rock climbing, surfing, a lot of our projects were focused on close-to-body technologies and basically we designed everything from smart sunglasses for triathletes to 3D printed flip-flops for beach walkers to smart yoga pants for people who wanted to become better at mindfulness. And so we basically covered your head to toe with technology that's comfortable, beautiful, easy to use and easy to wear. And along the way, we were always developing the digital experiences that collaborated with them. So from a UX UI standpoint, we always wanted those digital touch points to be as integrated into the user experience as possible. And as of last 2 years, we've been working with a company called Neuralink, and we've been doing kind of our first foray into a wearable that was moving not just on your body, but in your body. So we were working with neurosurgeons were the ones who were giving us the most guidance around kind of how this technology would go in your head. So just to give you a bit of background, if you're not familiar with it, Neuralink is a company that was founded by Elon Musk and a really smart team of scientists and engineers, and their goal is to be able to develop brain-computer interfaces, or BCIs, or brain-machine interfaces, BMIs for short, as a way to empower people to control technology. And I think Elon has a larger picture, which is to be able to empower the human race to compete with artificial intelligence. And yeah, he's a lot smarter than I am, so I don't really have that huge picture, but I'm very interested in the user experience and kind of the intimate ways that people would engage with this technology, and just trying to think about how it would impact people's day-to-day lives. So yeah, I could keep going on and on. So long story short, we started working with them, and that brings us to kind of maybe the topic we're talking about today, which is looking at how that the idea of being able to communicate via your thoughts or some stimulus in your brain is going to potentially impact the world of UX, UI somewhere down the road.
Before we dive into that, I'd just love to understand, because typical guests here are software people and product design studios are really a rare case. And I would really love to understand what being a design studio means in terms of like team structure, what part of your team is responsible for the digital experience, and like what would do generally, what does a typical work process look like?
Sure, that's a great question. So as a team that's doing both physical and digital projects, we tend to be fairly multidisciplinary. I say that with a bit of a caveat, because I do appreciate kind of T-shaped skill sets where people are very strong in certain areas and they're experts at them. I think if we were to understand our team structures, it's basically being able to focus our energies on, we don't like to take on too many projects, so we'll kind of pick and choose and work on the projects that are a right fit for our team. And a lot of our skill sets on the UX, UI side of things are heavier based on the UX, and also heavier based on kind of harder, maybe not harder, but more unconventional UX problems. And often that leads us into like world where hardware and software meet together, or where it's a multi-touch point UX experience where that you have to think through real world scenarios. And so the team is usually built around their skill set. So if it's UX project, then we've got a strong UX lead. And then we have fairly strong visual design talent in-house, but we don't really do a lot of like very intense motion graphics. And then some of the, obviously the development work, we kind of outsource to our partners. So it's a fairly agile team internally. And to be honest, because for those that aren't familiar with a product design studio, you work for companies who need your help. And often those companies are varied in size, shape, and form. So one of the values we do bring to the table is our flexibility. So often our services are fairly a la carte, which means that depending on what our client's engineering team and design team is made up of, we kind of mold around them a little bit. And in this day and age, we've seen a lot of kind of development in terms of how design studios work around being fairly kind of like an extension of the internal team of our company. So typical ways we do that is we all get on the same Slack channel and we all share a single Miro board. And there's a lot of transparency. I think maybe 10 years ago, design studios were a lot more kind of precious with like presentations and deliverables, where you had a mid-phase meeting and you'd share your great ideas and then you'd share your final phase and then you pass off the ideas. I think the way that things are going these days for the better is to be a lot more collaborative and a lot more transparent. So we really do work with our clients very closely. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. One more question to satisfy my personal curiosity is how you do the testing for the products. Is it like before you send something to official production, what happens? I always wonder like whether that depends on the budget, or is it always extensive testing and so on? Like, you know, producing teapot, like very simplified example, producing teapots, and nobody would actually pour tea from it until it's produced. But that's not a great practice, obviously.
No, it's not. I've got a mini. my teapot right now actually sucks. It keeps on dripping when I try and pour my tea. So I wish someone had tested it before they'd actually sold me that teapot. But yeah, I think it varies. For multiple reasons, various. First of all, if I'm putting on purely my designer hat, I think based on what the product is. So hardware products, it's pretty common sense, but the fact you're injection molding or making a tool that means that this product is going to be forever invested in with the money you spend on the tooling and you can't update means that you really do have to do a lot of vetting up front. And usually you see that in the quality of companies. Like, if a company delivers a product and it just doesn't really work that well, then you kind of know that company is not, it degrades the brand. And I think that over time, there's only so much marketing you could do to kind of like patch up the fact that you have crappy product. And then on the software side of things, there's the idea that you can always update. And if it's even a hardware product that's got some firmware built into it, you can then over the air update it. And so there's a little bit, I guess, the world of software is a lot more agile. It's a lot more sprint based. So there's two sides to that coin. One is that the user testing, which I'm sure your audience is familiar with, is basically being able to build prototypes that quickly validate and test and refine ideas in small chunks of time. And with the MVP, you're able to kind of understand what is the most important features you need before you ship. And then if you're able to kind of understand whether you've hit those sweet spots of getting the right features that people really want, really not nailed in with great testing, then you ship it. And then as you start to roll out new features, you're able to then update the software. And so the difference between those two platforms is with hardware, you have to be more thorough up front, get it right, because you can't update anything. And then with software, it's a lot more agile. And so there's a little bit of like, okay, let's get the most important stuff right. And then let's be able to later on introduce the newer features as time goes on and make some corrections. And it's a little bit more flexible. Having said all that, I think the last 8 months have been challenging for user testing. We're still trying to figure out the best platform. We started to get creative with like Figma prototyping and testing, Miro prototyping and testing, depending on what we're actually testing, whether it's a storyboard, whether it's actually a clickable prototype. We've had to start thinking about what we can do to be able to get useful feedback without being in the same place as our users. So it's definitely caused us to rethink our user testing protocols.
Awesome. Let's now talk about thought-based interfaces itself. And it's the topic that you brought to the table, which means you're very excited about this opportunity that you can later pursue as a design studio. So what is that that makes you so excited about this topic?
Yeah. So it's super interesting because of the fact that it's basically something that is very new and has lots of potential to change the way we're going to be interacting in a hopefully a huge level of improvement in terms of being able to more quickly access data and more efficiently communicate and have access to way more information. And it's, I think there's huge potential and also huge fear. And I think that because of that, it's a very interesting topic. I think it's also super interesting because the science of the brain is so unknown. And so all of this feels like we're moving into a world of where like design, engineering, and pure like brain science and discovery is coming together. So the idea of building a user interface where we might be able to project a completely new future for people, but we're not quite sure yet because we're still learning along the way, is super exciting. Like even when we start to talk about what a thought looks like I think sometimes in words, sometimes I think in pictures, like I sometimes have images come to my brain and there's no word there. So if you're designing an interface which is able to pick up on those signals, what is it able to pick up on and how is it able to interpret them? And the likeliness is that it's going to be, a lot more rudimentary over time than all these ideas we're having now. But I guess there's part of me that wants to imagine like, well, in 20 years down, when we really understood the brain science, like what could an interface look like? And maybe in 2 years down, when we really started to get the basic science a little bit better understood, what could interface looks like? And kind of even imagine that evolution, especially over the last 20, 30 years, 40 years of watching kind of the desktop computing world evolve in some kind of fashion. There's almost like wondering, will it replicate that kind of evolution of improvement, of miniaturization, of optimization, of people like adapting to technology and getting more and more integrated into it. Like I know that back in 2005 or 6 or 7, when we started to really do a lot more texting on phones, there's like the thumb generation of people who just got really good at texting with their thumbs and everything. Before that, no one would have thought that you would be like engaging in texting that regularly and that would be a motor control you would learn to pick up. I remember when I was grade 6 or 7, and we started to learn touch typing. My brain had to like go through this entirely mind-bending exercise to learn a touch type. I'm guessing that there's going to be some very similar learning curve around new ways we'll have to think. And I think that that's also what the scientists are banking on as well. There's one term called neuroplasticity, which I'm sure that your audience is familiar with, but it's basically the idea that your brain is very flexible in what it can adjust to and learn. So the idea that if you have this, if you potentially lose your hearing, that part of your brain that's the auditory side starts to take on new functionality, indicates that you can probably have new ways of thinking also introduced. So if you have a brain-computer interface, what does the learning curve for that look like? What are you, how does it feel? Like I was looking at some of the interviews with people who've had, just a bit of background. The world of brain-computer interfaces is not new. It's been around for a while, and there's been some great developments that have happened probably in the last 10 years. There's a lot of people with paralysis who've had this device called the Utah Array that is able to sense and send information, allowing them to control robotic arms in order to be able to feed themselves, take care of themselves, give them more independence. And one of the people who had this, I was reading an interview with him, and he was describing how there's also sensors in the robot arm that were being sent back to his brain that were pressure sensors of what the robotic arm was pinching, so he could understand the kind of the force that was being applied. And he's like, it created a tingle in my brain, and it didn't really mean what I traditionally would have thought of it as the pressure of grasping with my hand when I used to be able to grasp, but I learned over time to interpret it. So that makes you start to think like, wow, you're able to slowly start to understand what these signals coming in and out from a brain-computer interface mean, and you start to make sense of them. It becomes a second nature form of thinking. And so I think it's that unknown of what that actual experience is going to look like that starts to feed our curiosity as designers to imagine what the interfaces are going to look like.
What does the most realistic implementation look like based on the research and developments that's already been done? For example, you mentioned before that there's still the necessity of physical contact with the brain. Therefore, it's something that's implanted in your head that makes contact through the electrodes, or is it completely like wireless, or what kind of interface physically are we talking about?
Yeah, I think that based on our secondhand like conversations we were having with the team at Neuralink, if you look at the landscape of brain-computer interfaces, the ones that are the most successful at being able to read and as a result translate information accurately are the ones that are closest to the neurons. And I think that seems to be one of the biggest kind of deal breakers around the accuracy of the brain-computer interface. So a lot of the competitors who are trying to do it outside the skull just don't have the accuracy to be able to do anything that effective. So it seems like from a pure science and kind of maybe more from a like electrical engineering and signal processing standpoint in terms of picking up the signals from the neurons and getting the best read on them, it's basically being as close to them as possible, which means being implanted. And it kind of sucks. Like, it would be great to not do that, but I think that seems to be table stakes right now for being able to make this technology work. And I think from there, the great innovation that the team at Neuralink has been able to focus on is being able to take that idea and make it as streamlined as possible. So this last edition they shared back in August 2020, there was no longer the wearable on the outside, and it was all completely implanted. And then the idea is that you're able to recharge the device and then walk around wirelessly with that. So basically, you don't have anything hanging off your head like you do with the present Utah arrays. So that's the state of the art of where things are at. I think that the closest thing that we probably have is maybe a indication of where some of the at least from a material science and becoming more implantable is if you look at like cochlear implants, which have been the innovation around helping people that are hearing impaired tap directly into their auditory nerve inside their head. And you've seen them start on the outside of their head maybe 10, 15 years ago. Now I think there's research around where it's basically a little nub that comes out and is just barely visible underneath your skin, and it's become a lot more kind of integrated into the actual person's body in a way that they can live with easier. So
when it comes to the signals that we're talking about, you mentioned few minutes ago that it's going to be interpreted in some way. What is it? How is it interpreted now into language, into image, into any other signal system? What is that signal system?
Yeah, I think right now the strongest signal that we're picking up is movement. So if we're able to control something that we typically used to move with our physical body, then you're tapping into your motor cortex. And if you're able to move your eyes, and then you're able to kind of understand what your gaze detection and where you're looking. And so a lot of the things that are tracked more to our motor cortex are things that we've been able to understand really well. And that's where we've been able to see a lot of the examples around. And I think where things are going from here is where we're starting to imagine, well, what happens when we start to take that and then kind of build on it in both ways. So if we're able to take the signal coming in and trigger your motor cortex where it feels like kind of like what we described with the patient who is feeling the tingling and they learned that signal to mean something, how would you start to create a new language for yourself based on either combinations of a cortex that you're very familiar with or multiple kind of combinations? So like there's this idea of kinesthesia, which is like multiple senses being stimulated at the same time. What happens if you start to combine those together and you create a completely new language as a result of like bridging different senses together and stimulating them in unison? These are totally just our ideas. We're kind of working in the world of design and trying to inform ourselves through conversations with neuroscientists as well. But I think we're still in the phase of trying to develop out a lot of these concepts, and we're planning to start having more conversations with neuroscientists to validate them and see which ones are actually feasible and which ones still feel like they're a little bit pie in the sky. But I think that's what designers do really well, is to kind of come up with the ideas and then work with people who are more technical than they are to be able to validate whether they have the ability to be real or not. And then we keep on kind of coming up with all these use cases, which we think of, which was like, what does it look like for people to have, like, imagine if you're in a yoga studio and you're all connected to the same, I guess, setup, and you were able to have a collective experience of how the whole room feels or is thinking at the same time. It kind of feels like this collective mindfulness in a way. And then also the idea that, like, would you ever be able to have conversations where you're talking or hearing Alexa or some other voice command in your head? So it's almost like another voice that's living inside with you that no one else hears. And then it starts to become like a conversation you have in your head. And that's where we start to get a little bit nervous and scared. And we're like, holy crap, what's going on here? And it makes us think that the idea of having I think right now there's a little bit of a trend right now where people are becoming more conscious of what we're consuming, how much we're consuming digitally, and when we want to turn off. And I think that's going to become more and more a trend in the future, where people are like, okay, I'm using this platform now and I'm engaging. I guess 5 or 10 years, people have become a lot more aware of their kind of digital nutrition and what they're consuming. And I think that that's going to become more and more important as we go forward. I think that people are becoming a lot more kind of cynical of maybe who is behind the data they're consuming, who's sponsoring it, who's benefiting it from it. And so that is taken to kind of the extent when people have direct access to your brain. There's a book I was reading called Influence. It's The Psychology of Persuasion. And it's talking about just like at the present time, how easily marketers are able to persuade people of things, to do things and make decisions just through regular means of how you organize conversations and how you've typically marketed with people in the past. And now imagine if that's inside your head. That's extremely, it seems very scary. And I think there has to be a lot of consideration of what that looks like. I think one thing that's going to be really important is the ability to disconnect, to say, okay, I'm done. I want to have my own free will. I don't want to talk to anyone right now. I want to just be myself and not be connected. But that also begs this question of, like, when we talk about neuroplasticity, and if your brain spent all this time adjusting and becoming more in tune with the technology in order to work with it better, I wonder if there's any type of fatigue you would get when you turn off, where you feel kind of like almost like a sense of withdrawal, where you're like, oh, I just don't feel like I'm happy anymore. Like, I don't know what that's going to look like. And so I think because we don't know what that's going to look and feel like, it's just super exciting for us as designers.
I'm glad that you brought up voice UX, because first, these are, of course, interconnected. And then there's this concept of stair-step increase in speed of interaction. Let's say we write, then we type much faster, then we speak much faster than we type. And then you mentioned that we think definitely much faster than we speak. So that's going to be quite an acceleration of everything that's happening.
Yeah, but the funny thing is, even thinking, like, I was reading, there's a philosopher, I forget his name, but he was even saying that we think before we speak. So he says, like, kids can think and they can understand and they don't have a language to express it. I've also heard other arguments that say speaking and language is the reason that humans have evolved. So maybe there's like a base level of development that can happen, but unless you start to understand language, your brain won't develop to the optimal level that it can. So, and then there's the visual cortex, right? It's like there's been so many times where I've had a picture just pop up in my brain and there's no words associated with it. And then it's completely devoid of words. And then the words come afterwards. So even like, I still have a difficult time trying to understand what thinking is as a evolution of speaking, because sometimes it feels like it's different, but yeah. Just to kind of, sorry to interrupt there. I was just trying to build on your thinking, but I was just not sure exactly whether thinking was better, an extension of speaking, or different completely.
Then again, there's thinking in different languages, which is a phenomenon when you go to another country and adjust another language, you might switch the language that you think in, and that's all pretty fascinating if you think about it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that often there's this, people have been like in different countries, there's always that question of like, what language do you think in? And there's people who like still think in their native language. There's people who like moved away from it. And I wonder what that moment is where you switch over and what the challenges are. And imagine if you're trying to track. Yeah, I think that there's still like a question of like, is this technology going to be picking up specific words that you're saying in your head? Are you going to learn to think in a way where it's able to understand like you thinking in a certain new way? Are you going to speak a new like language just to be able to communicate with it through your thoughts? But that's also interesting too, because as you describe like switching languages in your head, as you go to different countries, that very well might be what it's like, where you kind of think in your own language and you have to think in, I don't know, the brain computer interface language to be able to talk to it when you want to talk to it. Otherwise, it doesn't understand what you're saying. It's almost like being in a country where people don't speak the same language as you and they don't know what you're saying. And then all of a sudden, when you speak their language, they understand you. So sorry, this is getting very high level, but also very inspiring, I think, for UX designers to be like, what the heck is this going to look like from a UX standpoint? And I think the fascinating thing with designers is every decision we make is going to impact the user. And so that's going to this extreme level where basically every decision you're going to make is going to impact the way that people think. That's crazy. That's amazing. So it's very empowering, but also very scary for UX designers.
We actually talked about a voice UX here on the show before, and I'd like to send our listeners to episode 173 with Sina Kahin. So we raised a lot of interesting points there. I wonder, for a thought-based UX, is there still going to be some kind of graphic UI in addition to the actual interaction? So is basically thought just the controller, or is it going to be the only channel that represents the computer, I would say the system.
A lot of our early prototyping concept makes us feel that it's definitely going to stay within the picture, because your visual bandwidth is so huge. Like, you're able to consume so much data in parallel with your eyes, and to be able to leverage that, it seems like a no-brainer. So I think the ability to like control with your mind, and then be able to the output be with your mind and the input be with your eyes seems like a feasible paradigm to start considering. So I think that's pretty spot on right now. And I think there's probably going to be a little bit of a further exploration we'd love to do, which is going to look at what the pros and cons are potentially of each one of those kind of architectures and understand where things are going. But so far it feels like the idea of using your eyes as a feedback loop to confirm and kind of elaborate on the UX, be like, yes, that's correct, or that's not correct, I think feels like a logical paradigm.
Voice UX development led to new professions, new kind of writers who would be designing the conversations. What kind of professions do you think will emerge in our ecosystem when, if a thought-based UX comes to reality?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I think back to the early days of, say, graphic design, like UI design working alongside developers, where you had a limited set of resources on your hardware and you had to do the best you could. Like when I think they were working on Elisa and they were trying to design the first set of fonts and they were trying to figure out what they could do and the first set of icons. It's like working within the limitations of technology. So I think I'd say that there's like designers who have a strong appreciation of some level of biology or neuroscience or signal processing, or being able to understand the back end of how these systems are interpreting data and then make some design decisions on the front end of it as a result. I can't say what it's going to look like way far in the future because there's so many different pathways it could possibly take. So I think just up front, I think those are the things that come to mind. And it's a question I've been asking myself as well, and I don't have an answer to it yet. I don't have a strong sense of exactly how the design discipline is going to shift a bit. I do think that there will be a place for visual design and for being able to understand what that looks like because of the conversation we were having earlier on about screens. But I also think that it's going to be like a multimodal interaction where you have to move between the things that are in front of your eyes and the things that are invisible that you have to learn to translate from the invisible to the visible and then build a UX off of that.
There is a book I've read lately called Seeing Around the Corners by Rita McGrath. And there are a lot of examples of past history when, for example, Netflix has won the transformation from DVDs to video in spite of the fact that it's been like looming in the air. So as an owner of a design studio, are you doing anything to proactively prepare or watch for such transformation in this area of thought-based UX?
I think it's just being willing to invest our own time and resources in developing up projects and finding collaborators to be able to further define and explore. So it's basically right now we're working on internal thought-based interface projects within the studio, reaching out to collaborators who are neuroscientists and kind of professionals within their own right in the world of neuroscience and brain technology, I guess, and then being able to start to build up kind of a platform of ideas, concepts, hopefully vocabulary of what this could look like, but it's still too early to kind of make claims like that. But it's just being able to invest our own time and effort with the expectation that when these technologies become more evolved, that we are at the kind of forefront of knowing what the user experience is going to look like for them. And also hopefully being able to guide the user's experience into something that's clearly beneficial for the user. So there's a lot of concern, and rightly so, for what the kind of implications are for a technology like this. And so constantly being aware of that and channeling those concerns into developing a platform that's going to put the user at the forefront in their best interests is what we kind of are hoping for by investing our time right now.
There's this analogy, for example, for voice UX, there are libraries for speech recognition and speech reproduction, I guess, and it probably is going to be the same way. So some giant megacorp is going to own the thing that's closest to the brain, and then all of us mere mortals are going to have access to the rest of it, right?
Yeah.
Something like that.
And now when you're saying the libraries, are those like the natural language processing libraries?
Like Amazon, I totally don't remember the terms, but like Amazon owns a few voice recognition APIs and things like that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think that there's definitely going to be that challenge. And I think that's, I don't know what the underlying kind of data risks are around that type of ownership. I do know that there's companies that are spending a lot of, like I know that natural language processing has been going on for decades and it's just getting better and better. And there's more and more like nuances and understanding different accents and understanding how people speak. And it's just a result of data sets growing. And I think algorithms getting better and more refined. And so in some way, shape, or form, that's going to happen. You're right. I don't have enough knowledge about the kind of the legislation or the politics or the actual data privacy management that's happening on the voice in terms of being able to have those companies that have invested that money to develop that technology to also be making sure they're consciously managing how they are using that data. And I don't even know if they have access to any of that data. I don't really know the architecture of how they build out those platforms when they're licensing the APIs, whether they're pulling any of the data that they're getting, or they're just getting, they're paying for people to use this software and then having the freedom to, for those other third parties to do whatever they want with it. But I think that presenting a super valid concern, which is that there should be a almost like the way that we're talking about blockchain right now of keeping people honest by tracking and having a record. There should be a very clear record of exactly where my brain data is being processed, how it's being processed, at what point is it being passed on to another organization, in what kind of rawness of data, and what can be done with it. So I think that ecosystem is something that should be tracked well. And to be honest, I don't really have a lot of insight into the way that the voice ecosystem is being built out and who owns what part of it. But yeah, it's something to be very cognizant of.
Are there any resources, books, blogs, institutions that specialize in our topic and that readers, listeners could subscribe to, for example?
I think that right now I'm basically just looking at a lot of conferences that are coming. There's one coming up at the end of this month that's going to be very fascinating. It's called Neurotech, and it's going to have a lot of speakers who are at the forefront of neurotechnology speaking there. So I definitely recommend checking that out. And if you go there, the list of speakers there is a great breakdown of all the people that you'd want to be tracking right now. So I'd say that's where we're excited about attending. And also, I'd recommend your listeners to check it out.
Awesome. Where can people find your studio and yourself personally online to listen, to hear more of what you write and produce?
Yeah, for sure. If you want to go to our website, it's woke.co. And on there, we've got our articles. We've written some articles about the ethics of brain-computer interfaces, and you can read about that. And then we'll be having some new thought-based interface articles coming out in the new year. So we're kind of working on our concept development for these new thought-based interfaces, and then we'll be sharing them in the early part of 2021. And other than that, I think that's the best place to go to. We have an Instagram account, which is where we post all of our beautiful images, and those are our platforms we're the most active on. So yeah, I'd say that's where you can learn from us and get in touch with us.
Thanks so much for joining us today and for sharing your insight on this very, very peculiar topic today.
My pleasure, and I look forward to seeing where it all goes in the future.
Thanks so much, and have a wonderful rest of the week.